for an animal to be preserved as a fossil, a lot of rather unlikely things have to happen. It has to be buried very quickly so it's not eaten or scattered by other animals. And it has to be buried in such a way that it doesn't decay. And then it has to come back to the surface at just the right time that somebody who knows what they're looking at finds it before it weathers away or is trampled over by goats or whatever. The relics we have of the ancient past are absolutely minuscule and, of course, not necessarily representative of what really happened. We really don't know what really happened because 99% of it is lost.
History isn't just a bunch of names and dates and facts. It's the collection of all the stories throughout human history that explain how and why we got here. Welcome to the History Unplugged podcast, where we look at the forgotten, neglected, strange, and even counterfactual stories that made our world what it is. I'm your host, Scott Rank. If there's one thing that all of my episodes on this podcast have in common, it's this. Every single one has taken place in the same location, and that is planet Earth. Well, I guess I've had a few that focus on NASA, but still the action is here on our terrestrial homeworld. But I've never had an episode that actually looked at Earth and the history of it. Well, that's going to change because I'm joined with today's guest, Henry G., and we're going to look at the 4.6 billion year history of Earth. Henry is a senior editor at Nature, the foremost scientific journal, and it basically makes your career if you're published there. And he's the author of several books, including Jacob's Ladder, In Search of Deep Time, and The Science of Middle Earth. We look at Earth's beginning, how it started as an inhospitably alien place, covered with churning seas, and against all this disaster, life began. And we're still learning new things today that completely shake up our notion of Earth's history. For example, 25 years ago, we discovered the first feathered dinosaurs, and Henry was in the room where it happened, which has transformed our ideas of dinosaurs, birds, and flight. But we also know that there's a lot that we don't know, and Henry has coined a term called the Beowulf effect, which applies as much to science as it does to history. The idea is that the Old English poem Beowulf only has one known copy that exists, and if we didn't have this copy, how much would we know about the so-called Dark Ages, the period between 410 and 597, where no scrap of writing survives from what is now England? Well, the same is true about fossils. What we know of the fossil record is an infinitesimally small dot of what actually happened. Almost everything that once exists on our planet has been lost, so anything new that we find has the potential to change everything. And finally, as someone who studies Earth from its beginning, Henry believes that the current crisis of climate and extinction, although real, he thinks has been overplayed and that we can turn the tide. In the context of Earth's history, a rise of a degree or two amounts to no more than he says a hill of beans, and immediately changing how climate is affected is like changing tectonic plate movement. So he thinks that there's still hope and perhaps some cause for cautious optimism. So this was a lot of fun to discuss. A slightly different tack from what you get. This is more science and history, but hey, it's a history of planet Earth, so we probably cover more in this episode than anyone I've done so far. So I hope you enjoyed this discussion with Henry Gee. Henry, welcome to the show.
Thank you very much, Scott. Lovely to be here.
Well, as my listeners know, I have a lot of cheesy jokes that I refer back to, and one of them is when I'm telescoping out about a subject and providing large-scale context, if I think I'm going too far out, I'll refer to the splitting of the Pangean supercontinent. So I'll say, the story of Margaret Thatcher begins 150 million years ago when the Pangean supercontinent split apart, because, like, okay, yeah, you need wider context, but you can only go so far. However, that is not applicable. That actually makes sense in the scope of today's discussion, which is the history of planet Earth. And 150 million years doesn't even do justice. We're talking 3 or 4 billion years. So before we get into that, what made you want to tackle the entire subject of Earth itself?
Well, there were two things I would often think about. Wouldn't it be nice to write a book, just a little book about the history of life on Earth? Henry's History of Life on Earth, I call it. But this particular book happened in a slightly different way. I'd just written a rather technical book. And where I work at Nature, the science journal, when I was a bit bored, I'd go and interrupt my friend David Adam, who was a news writer. And he's written a couple of books about psychology. He's written one called The Man Who Couldn't Stop, about obsessive compulsive disorder, and he's written another one called The Genius Within about mind hacks to make you perform better at academia and so on. And we were talking about books, and he said, why didn't I write a book about all the amazing fossil discoveries that I've been privileged to witness while I've been an editor at Nature? Now, I've been an editor at Nature for nearly 34 years now, and I've seen a lot of discoveries. I've been in the front row where scientists have sent their papers on amazing discoveries. So I was there when the first feathered dinosaurs were announced. I was there when the amazing little hobbit creature, Homo floresiensis, was discovered, and lots of other things like that. So I thought this was a rather good book. So I went and wrote the book, although at the time it was a kind of no holds barred expose, you are there memoir about not just the fossils, but all the people that were involved. And so I wrote the entire book and cleared it with all the people. But I also sent it to my parents, ever my harshest critics, who said, that's nice, dear, they said, but who apart from the people in it would really want to read it? So I said, well, my agent was a bit more tactful and suggested I just did it as a straight narrative, which is what I probably should have done to start with. So it became very complicated before it became simpler and simpler. And I decided to tell the whole thing as a story with not too much digression into the science. There's loads of the references in the back if you want them. I even started Once Upon a Time, so it was a kind of a bedtime story for grown-ups. And it occurred to me that a lot of the science that I was describing in this fictional form, as it were, was science that I was privy to as an editor at Nature. So I really did have a front row seat to most of the stories that unfolded. Of course, the story may change. The story's already changing. I mean, I know of research that would already modify some of the things in the book, either debunking them or emphasizing things I've mentioned. So the story's always changing, but I wanted to tell a story. It's a story. It's a narrative.
Well, as you have described science, I appreciate that, because one of my favorite exchanges on Twitter of all time is between Neil deGrasse Tyson and the account of Steak-ums, the snack company, where he said, the great thing about science is that it's true. And the social media manager for the company Steak-ums, a very low quality snack that you get at a gas station, said, science, what did he say? He gave a very academic description of science where it's an approach in order, it's not either true or false, but test hypotheses of which you can test different experiments. You're just being epistemologically lazy. So,
truth is a moving target. And it's in science, the truth is always provisional. When I talk to scientists, I sometimes stand up and say, when I'm talking to them about Nature, the journal where I work, I stand up and say something that my colleagues find absolutely shocking, and that is everything we publish in Nature is wrong, and we're proud of it. Because what I mean by that is there is no such thing as the absolute truth. Everything we publish is provisional and likely to be modified by further discoveries. And that's great, partly because if it weren't, everyone would soon discover what was absolutely true and we'd have to go and do something else, like play golf. So it's a process. It's not a dry accumulation of facts that can be definitely known. And that's particularly true of the history of life, whereas actually there is so little that we know.
Right. And I look forward to getting into this part here of how you reconstruct the past with things like the fossil record, which, I mean, it bears a lot of similarity to how historians do their work. And we're missing so many texts that we know that there's a lot that we don't know, which is frustrating, but it's part of the discovery process. But let's begin. I think that the salient points of the history on Earth, can you briefly give us a 4 billion year encapsulation of some of the key points that you think are important for us to know to frame the discussion? So this is sort of like the introduction to the Big Bang Theory with the Bare Naked Ladies song, where they're doing about a 30-second flyover view of the history of the universe. What are the salient points that we should be aware of the last 4 billion years?
Well, 4.5 billion years ago, the Earth happened. The solar system condensed from some globs of gas and dust and ice that were disturbed by gravitational waves from the explosion of a supernova that happened billions of years earlier somewhere else. And because the cloud was squished together, it started to rotate, and the center ignited to become the sun, and the bits outside coagulated to become the planets, although they did a bit of pinball here and there to find where they were going to be eventually. And the Earth was a ball of molten rock that was forever stirred up by being slammed into by other large balls of molten rock. And the atmosphere was very unpleasant and unbreathable. It was full of water vapor. But after a few hundred million years, things calmed down. All the water vapor condensed and it started to rain. And it rained a lot. I mean, you might think it rains a lot in Seattle, but it rained a lot for millions of years, until there were some oceans and some icy asteroids and comets added a few oceans. And then life began in the deep oceans. Life began almost as soon as the Earth formed, as a chemical system that exploited energy gushing up out of the Earth's core into deep sea hydrothermal vents. These mineral-rich, laden, superheated water gushes out and then catalyzes on minerals, and life began as tiny little chemical reactions in rocks in the deep sea. But it wasn't long until about a few hundred million years, hundreds of millions of years, we just toss these periods around like confetti, there were the first reefs, and they were made of bacteria. And the bacteria formed the reefs for 3 billion years. They were the rulers of the Earth for 3 billion years. So 9/10 of the Earth's history happened like that. While this was happening, of course, some bacteria invented a way of creating energy by splitting water into hydrogen and oxygen and getting the energy and releasing into the air a toxic, deadly gas, which is oxygen, which is one of the most reactive, deadly toxins in the universe, sparking the first of many mass extinctions. And life got a kickstart out of this what's called Great Oxidation Event. And one of the consequences of the Great Oxidation Event was the first and greatest of many ice ages. We've had a lot of ice ages where carbon dioxide was sucked out of the atmosphere. And so there was no more greenhouse effect. And there was an ice age that covered the whole of the Earth for 300 million years. Now, if life had a motto, it would be whatever doesn't kill you makes you stronger. So life became more complex. It invented the proper nucleated cell. And then happened what geologists call the boring billion. Am I boring you yet, Scott? This is the boring billion. This is the period of time that geologists don't really discuss because nothing really apocalyptic happens to get them out of bed. But this is where modern organisms, the earliest back algae, fungi, the ancestors of animals evolved. And then wacko, there was some more Earth movements and some more ice ages, but these weren't as big as the previous ones because the sun was hotter, so it didn't last as long, but it was about 80 million years. And after that, bang, the animals. And now we come into the final part of the story, which was about 500 million years ago, when everything else happened, the end.
All right. Well, that is quite a concise summary. When you were describing that, I was thinking of, I think it was either an NPR episode or a Radiolab episode, and they were speaking to an evolutionary biologist who was saying, if we found life on other planets, it wouldn't be terribly surprising to say we found single-cell life. But multicellular life would be much more surprising just because of the jump from single-cell to multicellular. It's not something we expect. It happened against reasonable expectation. So could you describe what are some of the most surprising things in the story of the development of life that really happened against reasonable expectation and why it's not something that we would really expect to happen?
I think the most, and the more I think about it, the more unreasonable it is why it is that human beings got up on our hind legs and walked. I mean, this is crazy. The dinosaurs were very good at being bipedal. But in terms of engineering, that they basically cantilevered their horizontal spine on their legs, and it was a beautiful structure. But the backbone, when it evolved 400, 500 million years ago, was a structure designed to be held horizontally in tension. And then about 7 million years ago, a group of apes got up on their hind legs and they turned what had been held horizontally in tension to a structure held vertically in compression. And the result is back pain and the major cause of absenteeism in the work today and a vast litany of maladaptive problems. And we didn't have a tail to cantilever a horizontal spine. We had to adopt this unbelievably unstable, ridiculous means of locomotion. And really, I think that's one of the most daft things that have ever happened in evolution, is that human beings became bipedal. there is no real reason why they did so. There are all sorts of teleological after-the-fact explanations. But something I think about is that people can peer to the edge of the universe with telescopes and inquire what happens inside single atomic particles, but we still don't really have any notion about why human beings got up and walked. And even the act of walking is still a mystery. There is no robot that has ever been made that can mimic the grace and natural grace of anybody who just walks along in a normal way, let alone run. And I think if I had to make one instant choice, that would be that. But of course, evolution is full of utterly unlikely events, because every so often there's a mass extinction, something comes along and wallop, most of life is wiped out. And the life that evolves after that has to evolve from what is effectively a random sample of what's left over. In other words, you can't evolve your way to hedge against sudden mass extinction. Who knows? I mean, that asteroid that hit the Earth 66 million years ago wiped out a lot of things, including most of the dinosaurs, the rest of them being birds. Who knows what? There was no reason for that asteroid to hit then rather than another time. I mean, this is entirely contingent. And you can think about that in history. It's something I've toyed with as an idea for a short story. There was you've heard about the Tunguska event, when some large fireball exploded just above Siberia in 1908. Well, if it had just been 8 hours earlier, or it might have been 8 hours later, it would have destroyed London in 1908, the peak of the British Empire. And who knows what would have happened? Would have there been a First World War earlier, later, something else instead? It's just one of these chance events that happened. In the event, it just destroyed a lot of trees in Siberia. But the asteroid, of course, that destroyed the dinosaurs was a lot bigger. You have to interrupt me, Scott, because I will just keep talking until I fall over.
But it's a big topic.
One of these contingent events that come along just when you think everything is coming along just fine and dandy, something comes along to interrupt things. Now, life, as I show in the book, tends to respond by picking itself up and doing something new, usually more complicated. But the asteroid was an event that happened so quickly that there was no way that anything could have responded to that in any sensible way.
Yeah, that's a very interesting point about contingency, because, I mean, the whole genre of alternate history, people love to play with what-if scenarios. Sometimes huge moments in history really do hinge on this or that person being assassinated. There are other things that a lot of historians think, well, something like the invention of flight probably would have happened at some point. It's not as if we wouldn't have airplanes if Wilbur Orville Wright hadn't existed, because a lot of people were working on the problem, but others aren't. The walking, the bipedalism, I never really thought about that, but I realize being able to throw a spear gives humans a great advantage. If listeners want to just go on Google Images, just type in megafauna in the Ice Age, that there are some pretty nasty predators out there. I know about saber-toothed tigers and the like, but it seems like everything a million years ago was gigantic and looked horrifying to try to kill in group of humans. But apparently we did the job. I'm guessing it's humans that wiped out megafauna.
Well, it's a bit of both. I mean, the last few million years have had very abrupt and sudden switches in climate. And mammoths, these gigantic elephants, lived only because they had a special ecology. They lived on a kind of grassland called mammoth steppe, which is not found today. And when the mammoth steppe disappeared, so did the mammoths. Now, human beings came along and with a coup de grace, as it were. But it's true, at the end of the Ice Age, in fairly short order, most animals disappeared that were any larger than a large dog. Mammoths, saber-toothed tigers, woolly rhinoceroses, giant deer, bison all over the Northern Hemisphere, vast camels in North America, the giant ground sloths, these armadillos in South America that were the size of a compact car. And they all lived until almost historical times, and they have all now gone. It's human beings were definitely in part to blame, although climate change also had an effect.
Yeah, so for the groups that I read are trying to genetically engineer a woolly mammoth, sorry, their habitat doesn't really exist anymore. Although there was some, I think, in an island off of the coast of Russia up to about 3000 BC. The time of the pyramids, which is crazy.
Yeah, there was this island in the Arctic Ocean called Wrangel Island. And back in the Ice Age, when a lot of the ocean water was tied up with ice, you could walk there from northern Russia. And some mammoths walked there. And then the sea rose and the mammoths became smaller, because that's what happens to large animals on islands, because of lack of resources. They became very small and they were living there. They finally got wiped out by hunters. But it really was 3,000 or 4,000 years ago that these animals were found. And the paper for that, about the discovery of these animals, came to Nature, came to my desk, the discovery of these mammoths. And because it was written by Russians, it was one of the most beautifully written papers in English I've ever seen. And the only way you could tell it was written by Russians was it said somewhere, these mammoths became small because they were oppressed. So that was the only way I knew. So, yeah, but, you know, if there's the current idea of making a woolly mammoth, but basically you're making a circus attraction, you're making a rather sad-looking elephant. But there's much to be said for rewilding in certain circumstances, but that's only if you've got somewhere to put it. There are wolves now that live in Germany as a result of rewilding, and I think there are wolves in Yellowstone and so on and so forth. But the habitat hasn't gone away. But the mammoth steppe was the habitat that lots of things lived on. Mammoths, woolly rhinos, giant deer, lots of things that no longer live now. And so that ship has sailed. It's something that really rewilding people should have thought of, because Jurassic Park, God, I remember going to see that as a press preview. I was sitting there at the Empire Leicester Square with my then girlfriend, now my wife, and we were in the front row, and the Tyrannosaurus Rex went, rawr, and we went, ah, and it was just amazing. We'd never seen anything like it. But you remember the bit where the two paleontologists going into the park and they see dinosaurs for the first time. And the guy, and so the Sam Neill character is looking at the dinosaurs, but the Laura Dern character, who's the botanist, says, yeah, look, they've got the plants right. The plants have to be right. It's not the dinosaurs. The plants aren't just scenery. They have to be right as well. So they'd also done the plants. So if you're going to recreate the dinosaur habitat, you have to recreate things, other things, plants that are now extinct. Of course, when the dinosaurs were around, there wasn't such a thing as grass didn't exist either. So they have to do all sorts of things.
Hey everyone, Scott here. We're going to take a very short break for a word from our sponsors. I was actually going to ask you about Jurassic Park. I know it's not a main topic of your book, but understanding if something is correct or not, understanding if something is wrong, and then because I do a lot of movies on my podcast where I like to examine why a movie gets something wrong about history, usually because it's just, sometimes the writer's lazy, but sometimes they're just inputting things that seem like it's the conventional wisdom. So it tells us a lot about our conventional wisdom that, oh, this medieval period pick is wrong about this because we're inputting all these assumptions that we have that aren't correct. Anyway, Jurassic Park, good or bad from a scientific standpoint?
At the time, well, look, it's a good fantasy.
Which can tie into your research about feathers on birds, which I'll
Exactly. I mean, when Jurassic Park was made, people did not generally realize that dinosaurs had feathers. Many dinosaurs had feathers. There was an idea that dinosaurs were related to birds, but there was no direct evidence that dinosaurs had feathers. Now, the franchise has continued and the dinosaurs still don't have feathers, but then it's a fantasy. Whether you could recreate dinosaurs in a test tube from amber, well, this is science fiction. It's taking current preoccupations and just pushing them a little over the edge. And the skill for the movie maker was to push the story along with sufficient speed and interest. So at the time, you didn't stop to question what they were doing about extracting DNA from amber and putting it into eggs and deleting something so that all the animals would become female and all that. Now, if you stopped to examine each one of these, you could pick holes in them. But because it was such a great story, it was an adventure story, you didn't stop to question that. But you see, Jurassic Park wasn't meant to be any more scientifically accurate than it needed to be to get the story along. But when I went to see Jurassic World, they had a kind of self-referential dig at all this, because the dinosaur villain in Jurassic World was quite deliberately a dinosaur that was manufactured and that didn't actually exist. It was this super, super amazing super predator that didn't actually exist in the real world. But there were a lot of things that played with what if dinosaurs came back, like these little velociraptors were very intelligent. And they were. They probably were very intelligent. And the great white hunter is training with velociraptors, and he says they hunt in packs, their vision's based on movement, blah, blah, blah. In fact, when I think about all those people who said that birds are not related to dinosaurs, obviously never kept chickens, because we keep chickens at home, and me and my wife sometimes rescue ex-battery hen, you know, ex-intensively farmed chickens. By this, I don't mean that we dress up in balaclavas and cut through razor wire and liberate them. But sometimes these intensive farms, they close and they give their chickens to a charity, and home poultry keepers can take them. Well, some of these chickens don't really have many feathers on because they live in boxes and something, and they're not very well socialized. So I remember my wife went into the yard to feed these chickens who didn't have many feathers on, and they were absolutely vicious, and they were chasing around and round and round. And she said, "Don't go out. It's like Jurassic Park out there." So it was really was just like that.
Yeah, roosters, I'm really impressed at how fearless they are. They will stand their ground against something many times its size. So if that same instinct was there in dinosaurs, then definitely watch out. Well, I'd like to hear about when you were in the room when it happened with discovery of feathered dinosaurs. And again, listeners, go to Google Images, look at artistic mock-ups of feathered dinosaurs. It blows your mind. You think, this is the complete opposite of what I've seen growing up in pictures and books of dinosaurs. It just, wait, they could have looked like this? I've been lied to. So what was that discovery like, and how has it changed everything we think of dinosaurs, flight, birds, everything else?
Now, here's the story. Back in the time of Darwin, Thomas Henry Huxley, who was Darwin's number one fan and publicist, said that dinosaurs do look rather like birds. But this was all thrown out of the park. This was all hit out of the park by a guy called Heilman in 1915, who said that dinosaurs don't have wishbones and therefore they can't get the clavicles, the thing that you pull apart in the Thanksgiving turkey. And therefore they can't be birds or have anything to do with birds. And that became the kind of received wisdom. And when I was a young lad in the 1960s, dinosaurs were seen as big and dim and lumbering and not very interesting, really. In fact, I have a kid's book that was given to me when I was five that hardly mentions, called First Look and Learn Book of the Wonders of Nature. And it doesn't mention dinosaurs at all, except it's a strange picture on the back that isn't referred to. Having a kid's book on the wonders of nature now that doesn't mention dinosaurs would be a non-starter. So dinosaurs weren't really thought of as very interesting or bird-like. But there was a young chap in Yale, I think, called John Ostrom, who was looking at some little carnivorous velociraptor-like dinosaurs and saying, hey, these do look very like birds. If you just imagine a bird without feathers, it would look like one of these. And he noticed detailed resemblances between some of these small dinosaurs and Archaeopteryx, the first bird, which has got feathers. So he said, if you took all the feathers away, you'd just think this was a dinosaur. And this was seen as a kind of a fringe notion. It got a bit of publicity due to Ostrom's swashbuckling grad student, Robert Backer, who was a kind of cowboy character, who publicized dinosaurs as hot-blooded, active creatures. And that was seen as quite trendy, but not very scientific. But then there was a cocktail party at the annual meeting of the Society of Vertebrate Paleontologists in 1995. I think it was 95. And it took place at the American Museum of Natural History in New York. And I would go as a representative of nature to the Society of Vertebrate Paleontology. Back then, I went most years, and it was mostly in the United States somewhere. And I'd meet a lot of old friends and get chucked out of room parties in the middle of the night and meet new friends and find out about what people were doing. So there was the cocktail party in the hall of the Northwest Pacific with totem poles on every side. And this Chinese scientist turned up called Peiji Chen, Professor Chen. And he's not a vertebrate paleontologist at all. He looks at little clams and ostracods, and he was interested in this new formation of rocks that people were looking at in northwest China. And he kept finding these strange dinosaurs with feathers. And he had this 6x4 photographic color print of this dinosaur with little clumps of little feathery like hairs in little clumps all the way down its spine, like a kind of Mohican. And he was showing this around to everybody, saying, what do you think of this? And everyone, and I was there at the time, and everyone was going, wow, it's a feathered dinosaur. Mark Norell, who is one of the American Museum's great dinosaur hunters, was saying, I'm on the first plane to Beijing. And I was actually standing next to John Ostrom, who first had this, who revived the idea of dinosaurs and birds. Now, Ostrom was then pretty old by then and with a cane and quite frail. And he saw this and sat down on a bench, and I sat down next to him, and I said, well, it's true after all, and all he could do was nod. But then I realised I should be doing my job and hustling for any research for Nature. And of course, it's at times like this that you realise you haven't got any business cards. So I tore off a bit of a beer mat and wrote my details on this corner of a beer mat, and I gave it to Professor Chen. And he sent us the paper on the first feathered dinosaur, and we published quite a lot of the papers back in the late 90s. Then many years later, I happened to be in China, in Nanjing, the Institute of Paleontology in Nanjing, where Professor Chen was a professor. And I'd been taken to the strong room where they show their, they have their treasures by the director. And I saw for the first time the actual fossil, because I'd never seen this before. And then we went out and we were standing on the campus of the Institute, and it's a very hilly campus. And at the bottom of the hill, we could see this little old man toiling up the hill. And the director said to me, it's Professor Chen. So Professor Chen finally makes it up the hill, and he's a changed man. He's unrecognizable from the chap I'd seen some years ago. And we said hello, and he takes out his pocketbook, and from his pocketbook, he takes out that corner of a beer mat on which I'd written my address some years before. He'd kept it in his pocketbook ever since. So that was quite a story. An interesting thing about working at a journal is you don't get to see the fossils firsthand. You just get to see pictures, and it's always a good idea to go and see them. Now, I hadn't been to China when the first feathered dinosaurs arrived, but not long after, there was a travelling exhibition that came to the Natural History Museum in London, the Feathered Dinosaurs of China. And it was held in a little gallery to the side, out of the main dinosaur gallery, which was rammed with school kids. So it was held in a little gallery, and you had to pay extra to get in. So that immediately cut out most of the people. And I went in there with my four-year-old, and there were nine fossils, just nine, of feathered dinosaurs, all very moodily lit. And there were the ones that I published, and I was standing, one of them was a big one, it was on a tabletop, and I was looking down at this tabletop, and there were a few other adults stroking their beards and looking significantly at these fossils, except for my four-year-old, who was whizzing around like a stray asteroid around this, and I was looking at this one on the tabletop, and this little face came up on the other side of the tabletop and said, Dad, did you punish this one in Nature? I said, yeah, that's what happens. People send us papers and we punish them. So that's how it happened. That's how their feathered dinosaur, and I was there. Steve Broussat, who's a good friend of mine, who's written a fantastic book on dinosaurs, The Rise and Fall of the Dinosaurs, and he was a good help to me writing this book. He wrote in The Rise and Fall of the Dinosaurs about that cocktail party. But I said to him, hey, Steve, I've worked this out. You were only 7 years old at the time. I mean, I was actually there. You know, us oldies were actually doing something.
That's really interesting. The difference between dinosaurs not having feathers to having feathers, I'm sure this sent tremors through the field, but what are the implications of them having feathers?
Well, there are two. One is that whatever they evolved feathers for, it wasn't for flight, at least not initially, because a lot of these dinosaurs with feathers were about as aerodynamic as a cinder block thrown out of a window. And some of them were just enormous when they had feathers. So nobody really knows what the feathers were evolved for. However, studies subsequently show that these feathers were coloured. They had colour. They had patterns. So, and that when the, as it were, the scales fell from people's eyes, they suddenly saw that dinosaurs really were bird-like. Goodness me, they had wishbones. Heilman said they didn't, but it was discovered that they did. They nested on nests, just like birds do. They folded their arms just like birds fold their wings. They scavenged the insides of their bones to provide shells for their eggs. So they behaved a lot like flightless birds. Their internal anatomy was very bird-like. They were full of air sacs, which birds, largely they were full of air. And so they became very bird-like. And of course, birds are intelligent. They're very sociable. They have display. So a lot of the feathers were presumably used for social display. And there's been a lot of debate. There had been a lot of debate about whether dinosaurs were hot-blooded. In other words, whether, like mammals, they could maintain a constant body temperature irrespective of what the ambient temperature was doing. Unlike, say, lizards and snakes, which if it's cold, they don't really do anything. They have to wait to be warmed up by the sun. Now, having feathers is logical if you're a small animal. So a lot of these feathered dinosaurs are actually quite small. In fact, they are bird size. And having feathers is really good insulation if you don't want to shed all that expensive heat. Now, a lot of the big dinosaurs didn't have feathers. We know this. We can see their skins. But it's possible that their chicks, we can call them chicks now, did have feathers and maybe lost them as they grew up. They had the kind of floof. So that was the first thing. They showed that dinosaurs really did live like birds and had a social life every bit as complicated and colourful as birds do. And they weren't the big lumbering behemoths that people had thought. Until then. And the second one was pre-adaptation to flight, because dinosaurs always were meant to fly. They always were built for flight. They had absolutely everything you needed, not just the feathers, but this internal breathing that, I mean, what happens with breathing is that mammals like us breathe in and breathe out again. And this kind of limits what you can do. It limits the size you can grow to, because you can't get too hot, because you if you grow to more than a certain size, because of the relation between surface area and volume, if you grow too big, you'll just boil yourself alive from the inside out. So but dinosaurs and birds have this air-cooled system where the air goes into the lungs and then circulates around the body before it comes back to the lungs into all these little sacs and chambers and vessels that penetrate the bones and surround all the internal organs, including the liver, which generates a lot of heat. And because they were air-cooled, dinosaurs could grow to enormous size. And they had a very, in terms of engineering, strong, light airframe. I mean, even the biggest dinosaurs, their bones are very lightweight. They just have bone along all the lines you'd expect for strain and stress. So rather than the big, thick structure, they're more like a kind of bridge where you just have the struts. You don't have a whole flat plate of metal. You just have the struts that you all you need to support the weight. So looking at it now, even the big lumbering brachiosauruses were not giant reptiles, but giant quadrupedal featherless flightless birds. So dinosaurs were, so the flying birds was really the kind of, well, hindsight's a wonderful thing, but expected culmination of dinosaur evolution right from the beginning. They were bipeds, of course, so they had arms which you could use to flap as well as pick their teeth or whatever.
Does that mean dinosaurs were just a few mutations away from flying triceratops, flying T-Rexes and the like?
Well, no, these were too big. I mean, you cannot change the laws of physics, Captain. I mean, there is a certain size about which you cannot fly because you just haven't got the energy. I mean, if you look today at swans or geese trying to take off, these are the biggest birds that routinely fly, and seeing them take off shows that if they're any bigger, they wouldn't manage it, because even with the flapping, they wouldn't be able to get the thrust you need to take off. And there were some very big flyers, but they tend to fly by sitting on cliffs and falling off and let gravity do the work, like pterodactyls were and albatrosses. So the flyers were generally rather small, and they would fly by two ways. One is by flapping very hard from the ground, and one is by climbing up a tree and jumping out of it. But basically, if you're taking off from the ground, you have to be small enough that you can generate enough thrust to get airborne. And of course, even now, not even all birds are very good flyers. I mean, we have yet to see chickens migrate, and our chickens are just good enough at flyers to flap up to low branches and to roost, and they don't need to go any further. So flying didn't start as a fantastic aerobatic activity all at once. So, but we wouldn't see giant flying. I mean, people have asked me if you'd see giant flying dragons, because of that we talked a bit before we came on air about Middle Earth and so on. But I do wonder whether dragons might have been airborne, because all those air sacs might have been full of hot air and they could have kind of had an additional flotation. But in the real world, I think to fly, you have to be quite small, at least to start with. And then if you grow bigger, you can't flap, you have to soar and use thermal soaring, a bit like gliders and sailplanes do now.
One of the few facts I do remember from my science class in high school were birds and their nucleated red blood cells with red blood cells that split. So they don't have bone marrow, so their bones are much lighter, which lets them fly. Now, their wings will also break if you step on them, which for us humans is kind of nice not to have. But okay, there are physics at play. Well, there's something that you mentioned I'd really love to explore, because this carries over a lot to history, too. And that's the Beowulf effect, that this revolution happened with understanding that dinosaurs had feathers because a fossil was found. And it could have not been found. And if it hadn't been found, there would be no empirical reason to think otherwise that they did have feathers. So we're really at the mercy of a discovery, which, I mean, a lot of history, I mean, you get out of the modern world, our most important texts from the Middle Ages, especially the ancient world, we simply don't have that many copies. The vast majority of texts from the ancient world are medieval copies that a monk was copying in a scriptorium. And that's just the information. So we know enough to know that there's a lot that we've lost and we don't have. So anyway, can you talk about what is the Beowulf effect and what are the implications?
Well, I coined the Beowulf effect in a previous book I wrote called The Accidental Species, about misunderstandings of human evolution. And I wanted to try and find a historical analogy for what you mentioned, that when we talk about a fossil, when you talk about the story of fossils, basically we're reconstructing, we're making it up, a narrative out of lots of tiny isolated incidents, most of which we know are lost. Because for an animal to be preserved as a fossil, a lot of rather unlikely things have to happen. It has to be buried very quickly so it's not eaten or scattered by other animals. And it has to be buried in such a way that it doesn't decay. And then it has to come back to the surface at just the right time that somebody who knows what they're looking at finds it before it weathers away or is trampled over by goats or whatever, which is what happens at Lake Turkana when I was helping to excavate, 20 years ago now. So the relics we have of the ancient past are absolutely minuscule and, of course, not necessarily representative of what really happened. We really don't know what really happened because 99% of it is lost. So I wanted to find a way in terms of a historical analogy for this. Now, if I were a historian, not a paleontologist, I'd specialise in 5th century Britain. And the reason I specialise in 5th century Britain is virtually nothing is known about 5th century Britain. The Roman legions went in 410 and said, I'm sorry, you've got to carry on in your services. And then St. Augustine arrived in 597 to convert the heathen Angles and Saxons. And so a period of 187 years happened in which there is no well-attested indigenous source of history from Britain. Now, this is almost the time that's elapsed between the Napoleonic Wars and today. And in that space, we've got two texts. We've got Gildas's Exidio Britannicum, which is some Welsh nutcase basically castigating the Britons by saying disaster came on them because they were not pious enough. And another fellow called Nennius, who writes another devotional text. And that's it, nothing else. So then I thought about what we know about Anglo-Saxon. I think there are, 24,000 lines of Anglo-Saxon poetry. Now, Shakespeare wrote more than that, and yet it took, those 24,000 lines were accumulated over 600 years. Most of them are written in one dialect, Wessex Anglo-Saxon, and probably over a fairly short period of time. And if you go to college and study Old English, you'll be studying this epic poem, Beowulf, which was probably a copy of a copy, much Christianized from a pagan original oral tradition, written much later than it was. And there is only one copy. And this is interesting. The copy's in the British Library. You can go and see it. Anyone can walk up the street and look at it. And the copy is singed at the edges. And the reason it singed at the edges was it almost was consumed by a fire. There was a collection of manuscripts, the Cotton Collection, and there were some other ancient Anglo-Saxon manuscripts in it. And that almost died in a fire in 1731. And Beowulf was one of the ones that were rescued, just. So I just imagine what we would know about the Anglo-Saxon world, the Anglo-Saxon worldview, the Anglo-Saxon literary imagination. If Beowulf had not existed, if it had, by that stroke of fate, been consumed in a fire, and we wouldn't know about Beowulf, we wouldn't know about Grendel and the dragon and Grendel's mother and the whole tradition of the mead hall and the telling of tales. We wouldn't know anything about it. But you never know, we might have known something else instead. We might have had the true history of King Arthur written in medieval Welsh. I mean, Geoffrey of Monmouth, that daft fabulist who wrote The History of the Kings of Britain in the Middle Ages, which is basically a work of nonsense. That's where Old King Cole and Merry Old Soul and all comes from. He alludes to some Welsh manuscript that somebody had shown him. So maybe that was true. Maybe there was a Welsh manuscript around that told what actually went on, and we've now lost. So basically, I wanted to create this idea of the Beowulf effect, which is the sensitivity of our knowledge of history, of our recreation of history, based on the tiny amount of evidence that we actually have. And if some of the evidence went away and we had different evidence instead, how different would our view of the past be? And that's really what I want to say. And I think somehow when you look at it in terms of history, it seems somehow more chilling rather than when you look at things that are, in other words, the things that have shaped our modern national characters could have been quite different because we might have known of different things. Rather than looking at dinosaurs, which happened an awfully long time ago and can't really affect us in any way. So, it's quite interesting how much, you know, you're a historian, you know that our reproduction, our reconstruction of history depends very much on what evidence we have. And sometimes there are enormous gaps and we just don't know what happened.
Hey everyone, Scott here. One more brief word from our sponsors. It's amazing how the trickle-down effects, I mean, for example, in monasteries, one of the core subjects that were taught was logic, because a few of the surviving texts from the Roman period were works of logic. And until different types of texts were brought back through Al-Andalus, this is what focus was. I mean, what if the focus had been, I don't know, some other subject? And then that would have formed the core curriculum and study during this time. I'm curious, as a paleontologist, sort of how the sausage gets made, because for historians, we have, I guess you could call them cheat codes or ways to work around exactly what you described. So, for example, one of my advisors focused on the early Ottoman period.
That's your focus, isn't it? Ottoman history.
Right. So that explains my vast wealth and how I have recruiters pounding down my door all the time.
But you probably explains your conversant knowledge of Turkish, Arabic, Persian, and other things, no doubt.
Someone has to do it. So I'm a little bit of a masochist because that's what some of those languages definitely feel like. But so, for example, the first Sultan, Osman, we don't have a single text from his time period. We have coins. And some Ottoman historians have said the time of his origin is a black hole. And the texts that we do have were written generations later. And they're talking about the politics of that time and imputing it to his reign. So, I mean, it's a fool's errand. And then other historians have said, well, I mean, that's a bad attitude to take on. So they've done different things. They've used contemporary sources from other empires. They've used prosopography, where you're creating sort of a generic stand-in for what this person could be based on these different models, sort of, I guess you could call it machine learning, one could say, of trying to construct it. And with genetic research and genetic surveys, which I'm sure you're very well acquainted with, we're unlocking all sorts of fascinating things. Archaeological ruins are telling us different things. So we can construct a model of what he most likely would have been like. And as long as we're honest and show our work, I think we can get pretty close. So I wonder, is there something like that in paleontology?
Oh, yes, it's very much like that. My PhD advisor said paleontology is the art of the possible. So you have to make the best of what you've got. And you can make reasonable speculations based on what you've got. So, for example, I worked on Ice Age mammals. I was looking at bison bones in Britain. And there are tons of them. They're all over the place. So you can say from that bison weren't rare and they were the dominant large herbivore for most of the Ice Age in Britain, because there are loads and loads. And you can say that reindeer only happened in the winter because you get lots of reindeer antlers, and they're the right sex, I can't remember, that male reindeer shed their antlers at a different season from female reindeer, and you can sex the antlers so you can tell that they were there in a particular season, and so on. And now in paleontology, there are all sorts of fancy techniques for dating the rocks and sediments, so we have some idea of the ages where things happened and the order in which things happened. Sometimes even with fairly recent history, we don't know the order in which things happened. I had this problem in the Ice Age. There were different strata. The researchers in London thought that stratum A happened before stratum B, but the researchers in Cambridge thought that stratum B happened before stratum A in the same interglacial. And now they're seen as completely different interglacials because of more evidence has accumulated to refute the ideas. And it goes back to what we were talking about earlier, is that scientific results are always provisional. And it's the same with history. You do the best with what you can and with what you can create some hypothesis about Sultan Usman and his times based on what you have. And it could be that somebody will discover some other text or some DNA or manuscript or coins or epigraphy that might cast doubt on that. We might find that Sultan Usman was a real person, or we might find that he actually didn't exist at all. But of course, that doesn't invalidate the efforts that you go to now to try and build a model to work with provisionally.
And another thing, too, that I'm curious about is because we know that there's a lot that we don't know, have you had discussions with others on what's the most wildly implausible yet possible thing that could have happened in the past? And before I hit record, we talked about an episode of a Star Trek Voyager, the shaggy dog of the Star Trek series, in which they are on the other side of the galaxy and they discover a planet inhabited by the descendants of Earth's dinosaurs, because millions of years ago, the dinosaurs, in fact, built not only advanced, but a spacefaring civilization, developed warp drive technology, which makes them contactable by the rules of the Prime Directive, of course, went to the other side of the galaxy and were discovered there. So, you know, I mean, who's to say that that didn't happen? And maybe you could argue, well, they would have left behind, you know, the remains if they had actually been a spacefaring civilization. So we can say pretty sure that that wouldn't have happened. But I don't know. Let's take the dinosaur example. Or if you had discussions on, okay, we know there's a lot we don't know. So who's to say the aliens didn't build the pyramids or whatnot?
Well, you see, this is the thing. This is the allure of things like conspiracy theory. And I mean, Facebook was down yesterday. So I said, so I wrote on Twitter, while you're all waiting for somebody to mend the fuse, here's a joke. Three conspiracy theorists walk into a bar. This cannot be a coincidence. So the allure about Eric von Däniken, chariots of the gods, all that sort of thing, cryptozoology, Bigfoot, Nessie, is that they could happen. But the thing is, the evidence that we have so far is that there is no evidence to say that they happened. So they're two cliches. One is absence of evidence isn't evidence of absence. So just because it's not there doesn't mean it didn't happen. But the other one is that extraordinary assertions demand extraordinary evidence. So, for example, when the little hobbit Homo floresiensis, this tiny dwarf creature, weird creature, fossils of which were found in Indonesia, and it lived till almost historical times, I said, well, maybe there are still hominins, human creatures that aren't human, living somewhere unexplored in some mountaintop somewhere. I mean, even today, new large animals are being discovered. Just when you think that everywhere has been mapped and surveyed, there are still things that have been found. And because the fossil record is so poor, who knows that we can't find something? So to look at the Voyager, I mean, it's a wildly implausible scenario, but doesn't mean that it's impossible. I've written a science fiction trilogy called The Sigil, in which posits a galactic civilization from Earth formed by primates back in the Eocene period. But, you know, what would survive from the Eocene period today to show of a civilization? So you could say, if the dinosaurs had a spacefaring civilization, wouldn't we see the dinosaur Cape Canaveral and the dinosaur rocket ships? Well, No, not necessarily. Things wear away to nothing in Ozymandias and all that. Things wear away to nothing in pretty short order. I don't think there will be very much left of human civilization if you looked back 100 million years. You might see the sort of greasy stain in the fossil record for a bit and the little green entities of the future wondering what happened 100 million years ago will scratch their little green heads with their little green tentacles and say, well, something strange happened, but we can't discover what. So in terms of science fiction, the Star Trek Voyager episode, just like we were talking about Jurassic Park, you can make an argument that this might have happened, but of course they're doing it just for the story. I mean, they do all sorts of other things in Star Trek, like have aliens that are all amazingly bipedal and look like humans, and that you can warp drive yourself from one place to the other in time for next week's exciting episode, and that you can go on transporter beams and all that stuff. But the great thing about science fiction is you can take... Well, hard science fiction is you can take some aspect of science and just push it a bit, just to extrapolate a bit. So the fossil record is so puny that all sorts of things may well have happened. Now, you could say that aliens built the pyramids and so on, but the fact is, I think in that case, we might well have noticed aliens by now. Aliens is another thing, really.
I can't remember. There was another discussion from, I think it was conspiracy theories about Adolf Hitler making it to Argentina, which, again, thanks to the History Channel, I've had to come back to that one a few times, thanks to listener questions. But I think it was about as poorly sourced as the way that was sourced was similar to alien visitations and alien abductions. And the whole point being that for an alien civilization, when I've seen speculative talks about going to Alpha Centauri, it would take a generational ship at our current, precluding things like antimatter drives or whatnot. For an alien civilization to get here that would be thousands of years ahead of us technologically, it would be such a massive thing that we would most likely see it. If we didn't even detect what they're doing, then that's unimaginable technology. And what are they doing with their time? They're goofing around with fighter pilots and being on the periphery of our vision. So it's possible, but there's something about it that just doesn't really add up. So it doesn't really pass the smell test.
One of the things with conspiracy theorist scholarship is that they tend to cherry pick. They tend to have a pre-existing that they want to support by cherry picking evidence to support it. It's not that they have a hypothesis and then seek to test it or refute it. One of the examples that gets amazing amount of currency in anthropology is the aquatic ape idea. That have you heard about this, that human beings started as very aquatic, and it started as a kind of after dinner speculation by quite a reputable scientist that there seemed to be a lot of features in human anatomy that suggest an aquatic heritage, such as we have. We're rather fatty compared with other apes. We don't have a lot of hair. Babies can be born underwater and all sorts of other things. But this was taken by a woman called Elaine Morgan, who basically took that ball and ran with it and came up with the idea that humans had an aquatic ancestry, basically by cherry picking all the features that were thought to represent aquatic ancestry and conveniently forgetting that it's very difficult to prove anything ancestral from current creatures, and basically by picking holes in the existing evidence. Of course, there were holes in the existing evidence. Of course there were. But there are also other ways, more sensible ways to explain things, such as, well, human beings seem to spend a lot of time in their history close to water. Well, the reason for that is things have to be close to water to fossilise, because fossilisation tends to happen underwater. And creatures that lived in high mountains have almost no fossil record, or in tropical forests, which is why we have a hominin fossil record, although not brilliant, is there at all, and much better than the chimp fossil record, which is, I think, one tooth that's half a million years old, and the gorilla fossil record, which is nothing at all. So there are a few orangutans fossils, but orangutans as a lineage has been around for a very long time and lived in a variety of habitats. And other things, from an animal, from my golden retriever's anatomy, would you be able to tell that it's a very good swimmer? Or you've seen the picture of goats up a tree, or goats on incredible ledges on mountains. And goats have these very thin, spindly legs and no opposable thumbs. So how is it that goats are amazing up trees? If you looked at a goat's anatomy, would you be able to predict it was a climber? And so on and so on and so on. So what happens is they take perfectly good holes in data and say, why couldn't something else have happened? You can't tell me it didn't. And now it's perfectly fine to speculate in the medium of science fiction, because outside the science fiction, nobody is taking this as a scientific hypothesis. They're taking it as TV entertainment. Of course, inside the science fiction, it has to be believable. There has to be suspension of disbelief. For otherwise, you just wouldn't enjoy the story. You wouldn't care about the characters or what happened, or whether the crew of the Voyager fell in love with a beautiful dinosaur or whatever. So I mean, I haven't seen the episode. I keep thinking, I have sat in the chair of the Defiant, though, on the Deep Space Nine.
I'll hold that it's the best series, but that's a completely different discussion.
Oh, that's another discussion. I'm still enthralled to Captain Kirk. Mind you, actually, I like the new retreads, the Abrams films with Chris Pine and Zachary Quinto. I think they're great. But that's another discussion as well.
Well, there's just a lot of really fascinating things in here. And it's amazing how pseudo-historical work and pseudo-scientific work has a very similar approach. So similar cherry-picking, similar... I don't know if I would call it lazy, because some of those people are extraordinarily hardworking, which is why this info is still getting pumped out there so vigorously. But just to kind of tie in all these things together, I'd like to come back to something you mentioned earlier, that if 100 million years from now, if we were looking at human evidence on the fossil record, there really wouldn't be a lot to be able to prove, just because what could last for 100 million years, even our most durable structures. And something that you do mention in your book is that with the public policy debate about climate change, and that we have a certain amount of time before enough carbon dioxide is released, that the Earth will warm by 2 degrees Celsius, that will cause ice caps to melt and will trigger this cataclysm. But a point you make is that if you're just looking at things from a geological viewpoint, it's not really that big. And you also say that there's, depending on how we look at things or depending on what we do, there's point for cautious optimism. So could you expound on that?
Yeah, first I ought to say, before anyone jumps on me or jumps on you in your question and answer show, that human-induced climate change is absolutely real and happening extraordinarily quickly. And measures to preserve our way of life, measures must be taken to limit the amount of carbon dioxide in the atmosphere. But then I say in the book, hey, hang on, this doesn't really matter a hill of beans in the great scheme of things, because at various times the Earth has been a ball of magma or a world of water or a jungle from one pole to the other, or covered in ice miles thick. So a couple of centigrade here and there really doesn't matter. And the bacteria that invented oxygenic photosynthesis didn't care that they polluted the Earth with a lethal poison, causing a vast mass extinction. But one point I do make is that, as far as we know, we're the only species that has ever evolved that is conscious of the effects we're having. And therefore, I think one can take a moral or aesthetic judgment, let alone a social or political one, that we should do our best to try and limit the amount of damage that we are doing. Now, maybe it's because I'm British. I tend to react badly to catastrophe and emergency and death and disaster. I say, come on, chap, stiff up a lip, keep calm and carry on. What? But these things are happening, and we should do something about it. But as for the cautious optimism, this is becoming evident in science. People are saying, there's been a lot of talk about whether we are living through the sixth great mass extinction. Now, in the past half a billion years, which I should say is the last tenth of the Earth's history, there have been five major mass extinctions. The extinction of the dinosaurs 65 million years ago or so was only the second greatest mass extinction. The greatest happened in the Permian period, 250 million years ago, where almost all life was wiped out by a 500,000-year series of massive volcanic eruptions and the toxic gas and the pollution. Are we living through the sixth one caused by human beings? Well, the scientific consensus is that no, we aren't, not yet. I mean, the problem, of course, is comparing different kinds of data. How do you compare data gathered over the short term with data that's very spotty and gathered as fossils, with all the problems of sampling that we've discussed so far? It's like comparing chalk and cheese. But trying to take everything into account, the latest consensus is we're not living in the sixth mass extinction, not yet. We'd have to keep doing what we're doing, deforestation, habitat destruction, pollution, without stopping, for another 500 years for it to even register as anywhere near the big five. But because we know what we're doing and we are already taking steps to prevent it, this catastrophe that everyone talks about might yet be averted. I think there will be a great deal of disruption. I think it's quite inevitable. But there are a number of signs of hope. And one of it comes from the fact that we've been looking at the deep past and we've been trying to look at measures of time. But when you look at it, a lot of the destruction caused by human beings is very recent, extremely recent, within the past couple of centuries, which is minuscule. Now, of course, you might say, well, since the Industrial Revolution, we've released all this carbon that took 70 million years to accumulate over the great coal forests, and that's a big pulse of carbon. Well, so it is, but it is still a very short interval of time. And I like to look back at other prophecies of catastrophe that have happened in the past. Now, back in the 60s, we all remember Paul Ehrlich and the population bomb, where back at the big crisis in the 60s was world overpopulation and everyone was going to starve to death and we're all going to be crammed full of people.
Listeners can check out my episode on Norman Borlaug to see how that turned out.
Exactly. Norman Borlaug, he and his colleagues, there were quite a few in Mexico. I remember visiting Mexico and talking to the scientists there. They created more productive strains of crop plants. But the result is that now there are at more than double the number of people there are in the 60s. And yet, in a very broad brush way, people in general are living longer, more productive, wealthier lives. The problem now is not the lack of resources, but their distribution. And there have been a number of factors. And in the 60s, population growth was at its greatest. In 68, it was like 2.5%. But now it's half that. It's like 1.3%. And the population will achieve zero population growth sometime towards the third quarter of this century, after which the population will decline and there'll be less pressure. And these things have happened due to a number of social and political factors. And the most important is the political and reproductive empowerment of women, which has improved education, doubled the workforce, even that you can't argue with the UN Sustainable Development Goals. Back in the 70s, only one in five people in the world finished elementary school. Now it's one in two. And there are other things, if you dig into the data, that in developed countries such as the US and the UK, per capita energy consumption, it plateaued in the 70s and is now falling. Now, per capita energy consumption is increasing generally all over the world, but after a while, it tends to fall. I mean, in America, people don't drive those huge gas-guzzling cars with engines at both ends anymore. And if you drive a car, it's going to be small and it's going to be much more fuel efficient and it won't need you to have your head under the hood covered in oil every 5 minutes. And here's a fact I found. Two facts. One is, in the last quarter of 2019, I love facts and figures, the last quarter of 2019, Britain's energy production by renewables outweighed those of fossil fuels for the first time. Now, that's just one quarter, and it hadn't happened since, but it's going to happen again and again. And the other one is, in the UK, per capita energy consumption has declined by a fifth since the year 2000. That's pretty amazing. Now, all the people talking about emergency and catastrophe tend not to factor that in. We are doing things. It's not as if nobody's doing anything. We're doing things in all sorts of ways. Sometimes they're a bit faltering, but sometimes they're not very spectacular or sexy. I mean, doing things just like insulating the roof of your house or something like that. And when you think about it, quite soon, well, the internal combustion engine invented in 1880-something. But in another 10 years' time, it'll be as antique as the manual typewriter. I mean, there'll be some around, and people will know what they are, but in general, everyone will be hailing an Uber or getting an electric car, and that'll be gone. So in the great scheme of things, the damage we're doing, although considerable, we are pulling ourselves back from the brink. So I am cautiously optimistic. Sorry, a very long answer. I've bored you to death with tons of I love facts and figures.
It's a big question, so that's fair to have to put the right context around it. Well, there is a lot more to get into here. So we've plumbed some of the depths, but they go much deeper, as depths do. And for listeners who want to check out your book, the name of it is A Very Short History of Life on Earth. Henry, thank you for joining us.
Thank you very much, Scott. All the best. Take care. Live long and prosper.
That's all for today's episode. If you'd like to see show notes with sources, maps, links, anything else related to this episode, and all my other ones as well, go to ParthenonPodcast.com. That's the name of the podcast network this show is a part of, along with James Early's Key Battles of American History, Steve Guerra's Beyond the Big Screen and History of the Papacy, and other great history shows as well. If you'd like to support the show, the two easiest ways to do so are to subscribe to it on the podcast player of your choice and leave a review. The second thing is to join the membership program for History Unplugged. If you do so, you'll get completely ad-free episodes for the entire back catalog, which is about 600 episodes and growing. And all you have to do is go to patreon.com/unplug. Thanks for listening, and see you next time.